This is Saturday, July the 23rd, 1960 at Fairbanks, Alaska. And it's during Golden Days, and we have some visitors from Yukon Territory, from Dawson City. And one of them will give us a little conversation.
Well, my name is John Butterworth. And I was born in Ontario in 1913. During the hard times, 1935, I came to Dawson. I think it was in March. My next brother arrived in April. My third brother arrived in June, 1935. I worked 7 years for the YCGC in their warehouse department. In 1942, I went into business for myself in the dry goods business. Got married in 1938. I married a local girl who had also worked for the company, same company, for over 5 years. We have 5 children. The oldest is 20, and the youngest is 2. My oldest boy is in Vancouver, working in a plywood factory. The rest of them are all going to school. I have one girl, 14.
Give the names.
Which is Joanne. Johnny is 12. Nancy is 8. And Carol is 2. About 7 years ago, we formed the Klondike Tourist Bureau. Been very interested in the tourist business over in Dawson area. It was through the Klondike Tourist Bureau that we raised sufficient money through Klondike Nights to purchase the old auditorium. We also had renovated the Robert Service Cabin. While our members belong to the Klondike Tourist Bureau, they are part of another organization, which is the Museum Committee. They had done considerable work on the museum up to the time until it was burnt.
The Klondike Tourist Bureau decided to send certain of its personnel to Fairbanks on this Golden Day Jubilee, is it?
Yeah, Golden Day Pioneer Day.
Golden Day Pioneer Day. There were 22 passengers on the airplane. 18 younger members, all in costume. One elderly person, Mrs. McLennan, was also in costume. The two old gentlemen, Mike Wenich and Teddy Watch, were not in costume. They are getting along in years. The plane crew, most of them, were also in costume. There was 3 cars with 2 passengers in each. They were in costume. It made a total of about 30 in costume. We were met at the airport, and we were met by the pioneers of Alaska at the airport, yes. We've had a pretty good time here in Fairbanks. We've seen a lot of country and met a lot of good people. Made a lot of new friends. the opportunity of showing them just as good a time when they come to Dawson, and we hope that will be August the 17th. Thank you very much.
That was Mr. Buttervich of Dawson City, Yukon Territory, Canada, visiting Fairbanks, Alaska, for this Golden Day celebration, recorded by Harry Hughes at home at 2156 Fairbanks, Alaska.
We left, and this is July 28, 1960, and we're assembled in the University of Alaska Home Economics Parlor, I guess you'd call it, and a nice group here. I hope that what I say is interesting and don't get too mixed up, and I'm not too good on dates. I can remember years, but I don't remember dates too good. But maybe you'd like to know my origination. I was born in Seattle and of a pioneer family. My father and mother followed the railroad from Ohio to Seattle, and she cooked for the tie crew while my father worked on the railroad and the ties. When he got to Seattle, he found the need of a newspaper. He had been an apprentice in Ohio to a newspaper company there, and had worked his way up from about 9 years old, barefoot. And so he got to Seattle and found the need of a newspaper. And I don't remember the exact year. It was 1885, I believe. And he became the first state printer of the state of Washington. He had the old Sunset Printing Company down on the famous First Avenue waterfront down there, which was the hub of Seattle in those days. And he was burned out during the big fire, and I incidentally was born in 1890. And I remember when I was a youngster all the way through, my father seemed to always be building up a newspaper or a print shop, and he was a great promoter. He could build them up, but he could always see too far beyond, and he'd go beyond his limits, and he'd be broke, and he'd have to start all over again, find financing. So at the time of the great Klondike rush up to Dawson in 1898, he was a partner in an old company called the Metropolitan Printing Company. And when they heard of this tons of gold being brought down, they thought, well, that is the need of a newspaper. So my father and another man started up and went over the Choku Pass and got up into Dawson, and they found there's no paper there and there's need of a paper. That was in the spring of 1898. The gold was actually found in 1897, so in the spring of 1898, found my father in Dawson, Yukon Territory. He saw the need of a newspaper there, so he immediately went back and assembled materials and presses, and this Metropolitan Printing Company financed him. And he bought all the stray dogs he could find. I never saw such a conglomeration of dogs as he had in our backyard. And they had stacks of some kind of compressed dog feed. I think the people that day, they just booked all these men that were people that were coming north with all these different gadgets and things that for them to bring up the Klondike things to exist on. So we had all these dogs in the yard, and he finally had a sled built, and it wasn't the nice sleds like he had now, big old London heavy sled, and he used to pile all of his children in the neighborhood on the sled and drive them up down the street and holler Mesh and Jean Hall, and people come to the window and somebody says, what in the world's going on here? A stranger in the neighborhood. Oh, that's crazy Hickman. He's out there nursing the dogs around. He thinks he's going up and making little money or something like that. So finally he got together and he got started. And there was a Gene Allen, a Plenty Allen, and a George. Well, George didn't. There was Gene and George Allen. Plenty stayed behind in the company. They were all interested in this Metropolitan Printing Company. So they finally, by all kinds of troubles and all, they got finally up to Dawson to find that there was already a newspaper in the offing there. There was a Klondike, Dawson Daily News. They weren't ready to go on the street yet to put out the paper, but there was quite a race to get the first sheet out. And I believe the Klondike Chronicle History was on the streets 1 hour before the news was. So, of course, my father, he stayed there about a year, a little over a year, and he was getting tired of it all, so he sold out and went back to Seattle. And you know, I got out there then and started another printing company called the Graham Hickman Company, and they made paper boxes and such. Came word of the strike in Fairbanks. He had to come up here. So he came up to Fairbanks in 1905 to find that there was a paper here, but he started the Fairbanks Daily News. And He became a partnership with them, Mr. Ward and a man by the name of Campbell, and they started the news. And then shortly after that, they became two or three other papers. And I bought this clipping. I don't know how many of you saw it last night. In our Golden Days edition, there was a little story about the early news at Fairbanks. And in that, they said that, made a correction. This is a correction to it from Bob Diamond, and it's out of Judge Wickersham's bibliography of early newspapers or periodicals in the Northland. And he has, I hate to dispute the word of the great Judge Wickersham, but I'm going to have to, because in this he mentions my father, and he says that, that he had the newspaper from 1906 to 1907. Well, I'd like to know where my father was or I was when I came here in 1908, and in 1909, my father still had the newspaper, and it was in the lower floor of the Masonic Temple, where the Masonic Temple stands now. His first paper was burned out, and if you notice in the Golden Dishes, the Golden edition of the Newsminer, they have a picture there. I don't remember, I should have written down the number of the page. It says Judge Bellows Print Shop. In that picture, my father is sitting with another apron on. It was not Judge Bellows' print shop. It was my father's in the Masonic Temple. And Judge Bellows, after they had the big fire here, my father was burned out, and Judge Bellows had a little money. So he financed my father in the style of another paper. And he picked up another partner then, the name of, McSmart. Tom McSmart, you remember Tom McSmart? Tom McSmart and it was Campbell again, and also my mother's brother, Jim Thurston, was with him. He came in to join them. So they started this paper then in the Masonic Temple building. And that ran through until 1909. During that last period, 1989, my father, W.F. Thompson, had a paper at that time. Now, I don't know, I haven't heard too much about the early days of W.F. Thompson, but he had a paper out in Bone Creek, and he called it the Tama Tribune. No, it wasn't Tama Tribune. It was the Dome Miner, is what he called it. So he used to come in on a Saturday night or early Sunday morning, about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and he and my father would walk down to the little town of Chino, Shinoa, some people call it, and they would help put out the newspaper down there. And then my father coming in with his whole head just swelling like my finger from the gnats and mosquitoes biting along the edge of his hat, so he wouldn't have his mosquito net down good. So they went down and put out that paper. And then when my father, in 1909, was having trouble here, they had scrip, the banks had scrip, the town was just about broke, and there's no money anywhere, and they had brought in men to buck the miners. I don't remember all that incident, because I wasn't interested in mining at that time. And so my father got discouraged, and he had a chance to sell out, so he sold his news to W.F. Thompson, thence making the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Now, that is a true story. There might be a few little things in between, but most of the stories on the local papers is a little confused. And quite a few of the local boys, Sam Crawford, the brother of our great local singer, Bob Crawford, an Army man who wrote the Army song. Sam worked for my father, both in Seattle and here in Fairbanks. Bob Crawford used to sell newspapers for my father when he was in the Masonic Temple, because Bob lived right next door, and his mother was running a boarding house there, near Barnett House, and he used to sell papers for my father. And so, see, I come away from the pioneer stock, though I myself am not a pioneer as much as a lot of these pioneers around here. But along my father had left his family behind all this time. We didn't join him. So about in 1907, my mother decided we had lived away from father too much, and so she insisted on coming up with him. So my sister and brother and father all came up, but they didn't think it was a place for a young girl in her teens, this rough country, to bring a girl in, so I was left behind. Then in 1908, I was brought up, and I joined the family here, and then I came up by the O'Neill Northwestern, and it took me 32 days to get from Seattle to Fairbanks, a whole lot different than going 3 hours and 15 minutes on the jets as we do now. So the O'Neill Northwestern was in September, the last boat of the season coming up to Nome and St. Michael's. And we took the outside passage, of course, and it was 5 days, almost 6 days, we didn't see land after we left the Victoria Island, is it? Yes, Victoria Island, I guess. And we went up and just, it had been storming all the way, and there was waves washing the deck all the time. As you know, the MF Western was never a comfortable boat to ride on. It was originally a freighter, had been turned into a passenger boat during the gold rush days, and it rolled about four ways at once. And but I'd been young, and I was 17 at the time, and anxious to get up here and join my folks. So I was out on deck all the time, and I remember there was this Captain Trubridge, and he had known my father, in fact, I guess, been neighbors one time, so he used to start taking me on his wing and walk and hang on to me for fear I'd get washed away. So I knew there was a lot of commotion on board because there was a lot of running around, bells ringing, fog horns blowing, and I knew he was having a pretty rough time of it. And the captain said they were a little worried because they were close to the Aleutians, and they had this narrow place to go through, Unimak Pass. And so early in the morning, about 4 or 5 o'clock, things seemed to be a little bit calm, and I heard a lot of bells clanging, and I jumped out and peeked out my window, and it looked like you could almost reach out and touch these rocks on each side because we hadn't seen land for so long. And just millions of birds, the sky was just black with birds flying, and here we were going through this Unimak Pass. Then we headed for Nome first, and being the last boat of the season, because things were freezing up at Nome, the boat was just loaded with supplies for the winter. And we landed outside of Nome, and it was rough and stormy, and they couldn't unload anything, so we sat out there all night just a-rolling and a-tossing. In the morning, about 5, 6 o'clock, the little tug came out, took off the mail. And then a little later on, they started to bring out the large barge, or lighters as they call them, started unloading. So I boarded one of those, moved to Nome, and visited around, and there wasn't much doing at Nome. And so when I came back, the captain had invited a few of us up in his cabin and took us all over the boat. I'd never been over a big boat, and took us all over the boat, and we had lunch up in the captain's cabin. So we were there in about 60 hours, I'd say, and everything was unloaded, and we headed for St. Michael. And we got out of St. Michael, of course, there were no docks. We had to anchor out in the ocean as we did at Nome. Had to go through the same thing. But, of course, as I was coming up the Yukon, I had to go in St. Michael and stay there. So we put us aboard a little tug called the Meteor. And it had straps hanging from the ceiling. I don't know if anybody had been on that little tug or not. But they put us aboard that, and we hung on straps. There were so many there. And we just bounced around like you're hanging a streetcar that's crowded on these straps while this boat was just going around circles, it seemed like. And we finally got over to Nome and got landed, but they had quite a time getting all the stuff over. And we found out we had just missed the boat that Sarah had just gone up the Yukon that we were supposed to get. She couldn't wait any longer. They didn't think it was going to send another boat up, but here they had all these supplies. They had to get them up. So they said they'd chance it, getting another boat up. The Susie was there. They was getting ready to put the old Susie on the ways. So we decided, we'll send the Susie up. And it took a week. I was in St. Michael's just about a week, and you can imagine how a girl 17 felt being in a place like that. And there was a boat on the ways there that was called the Nunavak, and we wanted to get it up here for the spring to do refitting and so forth up the smaller streams. So they were going to bring the Nunavak up, and there were a crew rushing around to get it ready. And so when there was a young fellow at that time by the name of Huey, you see a lot of the old photographs with Huey and Highland on them. This Huey, at one time, when my father had the Graham Hickman Printing Company, had been a photographer and had printed pictures for my father's work there. They did beautiful works like the Newsmarine does now with all the fancy colored pictures and photographs and lithographing and stuff like that. So he happened to see my name on the register list, and he came over to see if by any chance I was Zach Hickman's daughter. And so he kind of took me in his wing, and he walked me around to all the native villages and brought me quite a few souvenirs. And then he said, come on and see the boat I'm going up on. So he took me over to this Nunavak up on the ways there, and I got no time. He took me on this boat. We had to climb up the ladder to get up on the boat, and we had coffee with the boys there. And while he was there, a couple of fellows from the Susie came in, and there was one captain, he was pilot Newcomb. His father was the Captain Newcomb that was going to pilot the Susie up, and young Ralph was a young fellow, very good looking, and I nearly fell head over heels in love with him, but I know that there's no chance there. So anyway, there was another freight clerk with him. I'm trying his name, but anyway, there's another young lady and myself. We were only two young girls on the boat. There was a school teacher that had come up to teach at St. Michael, and she was off someplace, but on the way up to Susie's, there was only these two girls and myself, this girl and myself, and a couple of lady women that got up a little farther, got off a little farther up the river. So we sat and visited, and they found he was going up on the Susie, and so we had plenty of escorts the rest of the week while we was waiting for the Susie to get ready to go. They finally gave us order to board, and we stayed at a fine little old hotel that the Northern Commercial Company had down there, and we stayed at this place and boarded, and they had to take care of us all the time we was there, of course, because it wasn't our fault we were delayed. And believe it or not, that trip cost only $129. Imagine what it costs now, but it cost $109 from Seattle to Fairbanks. And see how long we were delayed, 32 days, and that was our price for coming up, no extra charges. And so then we finally got started. They told us to board the boat. We went over, and a big storm came up in the night, and they had the boat anchored at the dock. So in the middle of the night, I thought, well, gee, we're heading up, and finally they didn't say anything to us that we were going to start up the river now. And but they had to take us from the dock and anchor us out in the bay, because the boat was down to pieces on the dock. They had no way to hold it. And they said that during the night, two or three hog chains, wherever we are, to hold the boat together, had broken. So we had another delay getting these hog chains fixed. And then finally the next morning, they pulled us back over to the dock, and everything was ready, and off we started. Well, we got over into the mouth of the Yukon. I don't know how many of you know that the mouth of the Yukon is governed by the tide. And I think they had a 48-hour tide there. Anyhow, they finally had the Nunavak on the water. They finally got it anchored during this week. And the Nunavak and the little Reliance was on its maiden voyage. And there was the Susie. There was about six boats all going up in the broad delta there. We got up into there, and the tide dropped. And here we were, all high and dry. The paddle wheels were half out of the water, you know, and we were moving there. Well, this young Captain Newcomb and this other boy in hand, wherever he was, they launched a boat. And so we girls, we got in this boat, and we went all around to the other boats and visited and had coffee, and even went duck hunting out in the flats while we was moving there, and we really had a wonderful time. And finally we boarded the boat and headed up again. Well, being the last boat of the season, the Susie had four barges. She was shoving two ahead and one on each side. And that was quite a maneuver. And we didn't travel at night, unless it's a very bright moonlight night. She'd tie up at the bank at night. And every little village that we'd come to, we'd have to stop and unload. They would be there for hours unloading their winter supplies. So we'd always go to the villages and visit around and take in all the sights that were on the way up. Then we got up here to the town over there. It was Fort Gibbons at that time. They call it Tamanaw. And there we dropped two of the barges. That is, the Susie was going to go on up to Dawson. So she took two barges on up to Dawson. And then the other two, one was left at Tamanaw. I believe by that time it was empty to be left there. And then the other barge was all piled full. And we were transferred to, at Fort Gibbons, or Tamanaw, it's known now. We were transferred to another smaller boat called the Tamanaw. I don't know what's happened to the Tamanaw. You know, Frank, the old boat Tamanaw was a beautiful boat. And we were transferred to that. And it took the other barge, and it started up the river. And it started to snow, and there was shore ice, and the town was a wood burner. And we'd stop at the wood camps, and they'd lay down wood at the different places. And we finally got up to the little town of Chenoa down here. Well, it was quite a debate. We delayed there several hours. There was this little narrow gauge railroad running down. And they knew that if they sent us upon the railroad, it cost them more money. They'd have to pay our fare up. If we stayed on the boat, that would go for the same price of our ticket. So we debated what to do, and the little Reliance had gotten up there, and she was tied at the dock. And Milan was a big town. It had pilings and warehouses, and you never could believe it now. We're out into the river, and it was quite a good-sized town. So that was the town of Chenoa. We call it China. Some say Chenoa, and I don't know what the right pronunciation is. I've heard both, but to me it's always China. So anyway, we stayed there all night to kind of debate what to do with. So in the morning, they said that the Tamanaw was going to have trouble with that barge, and they were going to load the supplies and put them on the railroad, send the supplies up on the railroad, because we would never make it. The river was so low. So they took us passengers off, just the other girl and myself, and about a dozen men by that time. They took us all off and put us on the little Reliance. Well, there's no place to sleep. We were all tired. We'd been up all night. and we just stood around, and we pulled out into the river, and lo and behold, the Reliance was up on the sandbar, and here we were, and they chugged and they pulled and they tied cables to trees and stumps and tried to get us off. And while we were there, why, I guess they decided to try the Tananaw. And the Tananaw chugs by us and goes right on by, and here we are, high and dry. The Tananaw comes on up to Fairbanks. And if we weren't mad, and we, of course, kid-like, we kept on coming, get us and take us off and so forth. And I don't know how long we were hung up there, but we were there all that day pretty near. I don't remember just exactly, but I know how it was. We got to Fairbanks. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. I think it was, we landed in the evening. We'd been all day at Chima, and we started out in the evening. That was it. And then the Tanner went by and left us. And because I know we landed up here, we got stuck on 2 sandbars before we got up to Fairbanks because the water was so low, and these big, deep sandbars come clear out into the river. And they'd put down these poles, try to heist the boat over. That didn't help, and they'd tie the stumps, and the stumps would pull and break, and they're having quite a time. So we finally got up with inside of Fairbanks, and we hung on what they call home bar, just below where the power plant stands down here now. It's a big one that jets out into the river there. Lots of you know it. And we hung up there, and here we were, and we were chugging and working. And as we lived up, my father had a house upon 8th Avenue, not too far, about 4 or 5 blocks from the river. They could see the steam and hear the boat chugging down there. So they sent my sister down to see if they could see me on board the boat. And so she ran down, and she started hollering, "Clara, Clara." And the captain says to me, "Is that a relation of yours?" And I said, "Well, I guess it's my sister. I haven't seen her for 2 years. So he said, "Would you like to go ashore?" I said, "Well, yes, I'd like to go ashore, all right, but I can't walk the waves." And he said, "Well, we'll put out the boat here." I guess it was a lifeboat or rowboat, whatever you call it. So they launched that boat. And it was Mr. Lipman Simpson, remember him. He had come up from Maine all the way on the boat with us. Mr. Lipman Simpson was there, and I don't know the names of some of the others, but this other girl and myself, we were put ashore in the rowboat. And here we were, and we had low shoes on, light coats. It was about 2 feet ashore out. And of course, my weight, I stepped on, and I went down through and got my feet wet. And there'd been a little snow on the ground. And so we, 5 o'clock in the morning, we were walking up, and the boards were creaking under our feet. There were sidewalks clear down there then. So we walked down up home, and that's where I landed in Fairbanks in 1908. Was by a rowboat, and I come from Seattle 32 days every inch by water. And so then after arriving here, I consequently was married and raised 6 children, all graduated from Fairbanks High School. They're scattered, of course, two here and two in Seattle and two in California. So I guess that's all. If you have any questions to ask, I'll be glad to answer them. Maybe you'd like to hear about this witchcraft disc that was in the paper. I think a lot of that was in the paper.
Before you know about that, could you give us the name of your father's paper here?
It was the news, Fairbanks Daily News.
Fairbanks Daily News.
And his name was Zach F. Hickman, H-I-C-K-M-A-N. My father was a very quiet, retired man. He never got out and did anything foolish, or didn't get his name into the news too much. That's why you don't hear too much of him. But you look, now this paper here has his name in it. There are several publications that try to tell the history of the papers that has his name in. There's papers, Chronicle of Early Dawson, we found his name there associated with the Dawson Daily News. But like W.F. Thompson, he didn't write these terrible headlines. I remember one time we were all shocked to death. We picked up the paper. There had been a hanging. And here across the top was Jerk to Jesus. And here it was W.F. Thompson's type of work. Well, my father didn't put out papers like that. He got his name for doing things like that, Mr. Thompson. He was always called Young Funk Thompson. A very spectacular character, you know, but my father was not too much of a drinker. He would take a drink and die up, but W.F. was never known to be sober, I don't believe. And so I hate to do so bad against him, but he was a grand person. He raised a wonderful family, and he had a dying little wife, so I'd hate to say anything against W.F.
May I ask, do you remember what years it was called the Newsminer Citizen?
No, the Alaska Sioux. Now, this little paper here says that the Alaska Sioux, that's another reason I want to contradict great Judge Wickersham. It says the Alaska Citizen in 1910. When I got here, the Alaska Citizen was growing strong. And if you notice in several of the old papers when they show the bridge and the Catholic Church across it, you'll see the Alaska Citizen. some of my pictures that have been.
The one I'm referring to. I have a copy.
But it's never a newsminer
citizen.
Well, I don't mean about that then.
I had a copy.
What year was it published?
1923 is this issue that I have, but it was prior to that time it was called that.
You think so?
Yes, Progress Edition, 1923.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a little neat. Well, I was busy having a child right about that time, so I don't know what was happening, but I don't know about that. No, I don't know that one.
I put it in the cabin, and I
thought
it was the
old
long snap
cabin. And it's called the...
News Miner Citizen.
I need a long snap out there, yes, ma'am.
I have that cabin at home,
too. Oh, you do? I wondered who had it. Well, well, to go back to this story, my husband's mother, as a young girl, she was on the, her father was a Norwegian ship captain, and she was raised on these Norwegian sailing boats. She was blind until she was 9 years old, and she seemed to have a second sight. She would tell the captain, there's going to be a storm. And he knew that he could depend upon that. She was right, there'd be a storm coming up. Or she had mentioned something else that was going to happen. And sure enough, it would happen. So as she grew up, she learned to make use of this second sight. When she was about 14, 15 years old, some great doctor and I took her under his hand, and he decided to operate and said she was too brilliant a girl to go blind. So they operated on her and managed to save one eye and partially sight on the other. So she developed this phenomenal, whatever it was, instinct that she had. And she became known as the great palmist and mind reader and so forth. And she practiced that back in Chicago and in Montana. And wherever she went, she did a little sewing. She was a great dressmaker. In fact, she'd been a dressmaker for Watermaker and Company in Chicago in the early days. And she would do this on the side. But when she was a widow and she went up to Dawson, she heard about the fabulous money being made up there. She opened up a little place called Madamino. And she had that in 1898 in Dawson, this Madamino. People would go to her and ask her advice on mining and so forth. So there's this one miner. He would never go out mining or buy or put any money into anything without consulting her. And several times, he had made pretty good money on her advice. And often he would give her quite a little bit of his money for a good fee for this. And this one time he came to her and asked about this venture he was to go into. And she said, no, don't do it. You're going to be built. That the people, all they want is to get you. So don't go into it at all. Stay away from it. And so he didn't. And men were pretty perturbed and mad about it. Another man came along and asked her about going into, another man came along with the same one, wanting to invest in his mine, but he needed a little financing. And she said, yes, go ahead. She said, I think that that's a good proposition. It looks to me like you're going to make good on it. And he did. He made a fortune and he left the country. And so these are...
Will you terminate that portion of the tape? End of part one.
Oh, well, they tell me this is end of part one. I guess I've gone over, so. Well, this is part two. It's called Rough Talking, and we're starting into part two. And how much of that did we get on? But how much of the witchcraft? Did I have any of it on before at all?
Yes, right up to the time
stop. Well, to go back to this story of my mother-in-law, Madame Reno, and this witchcraft deal, well, this man that she had advised, he made a nice sum of money and left the country. Immediately afterwards, the people that she had told, that had tried to get this man to go in with them, they were very upset and showed the type of people that they were, that they would have gypped this man. Well, they had her arrested for his witchcraft. And so she was brought up into the courts of, you can find it if it's not all brought up now in the history of old Dawson. She's brought up into court for witchcraft, for advising these men on this mining. And of course it made a lot of publicity and good and bad for her. But she went on there with her work, and she married a man by the name of Madole, Ben Madole. He was a cook there. And so she and Ben, when they heard of the strike down here at Fairbanks, then they left for Fairbanks and came down here. And of course she just went right on then with her palmistry and reading and so forth. I don't remember if you remember her, Frank, or not. She was used to be, her last place she was on 2nd Avenue there, right second off of Cowell's, that little log house. In fact, that's the house just now married in right there. So they asked me to go back and tell about this trip up the river on the Susie. I was saying that the Susie was such a beautiful boat. One just doesn't realize, unless they've been on the river boats, how beautiful these boats are. And the Susie was all painted white inside. She had beautiful red carpets. All the woodwork was white, and a little polished mahogany here and there. And they had hanging baskets hanging all in the archways. And the staterooms were very well appointed. And of course, that time of year, I was lucky to have one all to myself. And so I was acquainted with these boys. And this story I'm going to tell you, because I don't think many have had that experience. Knowing this Captain Newcomb, he was Pilot Newcomb then, he was going to be on the night watch. And he and this other young fellow, come to think of his name is Weber. I think they call him Handsome Harry, Harry Weber, something like that. Anyway, that's like Captain Newcomb, he's in Salem now, told me. And so they were talking about how beautiful the moonlight was on the river. And I said, oh, I'd love to see that. And they were talking about having their lunch up there. So through the conversation, they invited this other girl and I to come up to the pilot house and have their midnight lunch with them. So about 12 o'clock, quarter to 12, when the busboy or waiter, where he was, was taking their lunch up to him, he tapped on our door and woke us up. And we dressed and went up the pilot house. Well, the most beautiful sight I ever saw in my life was on that Yukon coming around the point, you know. We had to listen to those beautiful chimes. We hope that they are on the recorder. Mm-hmm. We were in the pilot house, and I don't think anyone has ever seen a more beautiful sight than going up that river. And that moonlight, as we come around the point, you know, and the sandbars way off in the distance, and of course at that time the foliage was off of the trees, but it was the most gorgeous sight. And once in a while there'd be a tall, towering white-capped peak way off in the distance, and all the way up the Yukon. It was very picturesque. And when I went down to Nome, we flew over that. And it's hard to believe that that was the river that I came up that time, because it was really gorgeous. And I enjoyed that trip immensely. While I was anxious to get home, and took a long time, but I really enjoyed that. And I don't know now, is there anything else you want to know, or any questions that...
What was the name of your
mother-in-law
who was trained for witchcraft?
Her name was, at that time, she was Mrs. George Rust, R-U-S-T.
That's
and,
the name of your mother-in-law.
That's the name of my mother-in-law at that time. And then she was married to this Ben Madole, M-A-D-O-L-E. And then she moved to Fairbanks, and then she was married again to, I guess, Myers, a Mr. Fred Myers, who's mining out here on the way, El Dorado. And then she decided there wasn't anything more. She was still on the side doing this palm reading, and then Kodiak. They had these oil finds at Kodiak. So she decided to go down to Kodiak, and she opened up her palmistry and so forth down there. And while there, she married a man by the name of Anderson, Hilbert Anderson. I think it was this spring or a year ago he was burned, or he died on a boat or something down there. I read something about that. But anyway, she became sick while down there, and she was sent up here to Fairbanks, and she hadn't been here but a week when she passed on in St. Joseph's Hospital here. Very colorful figure and very wonderful woman, and I had any contact with her. You don't often hear people talk about their mother-in-laws, but being so kind that she was... I mean, my mother to me, helped me raise my six children. She's a very, very wonderful person.
How did she get out of this accusation of witchcraft?
Well, it was just thrown out of court to a certain extent, you know. They brought it up and had her open to all kinds of ridicule and so forth. She had a lot to live down, and it followed her. When I first came to Fairbanks as a young girl, I was hearing that she was an unsavory character, I had been told. But to me, she was always wonderful. I never take people... for what they tell me of others. I take people as I find them, and she was so very wonderful. I met her. She was a friend of my mother's and father's. In the early days, you know, everybody didn't have the modern conveniences in their home. And so there were several bath houses in town, and you get so many tickets for a bath for a dollar. And so she advertised in my father's paper in the Fairbanks Daily News. And so she wasn't doing so awfully good, and in return, she had this bathhouse, and in fact, this where the old Oddfellows Hall is now up here on 2nd Mountain. That was a bath that was originally built for this bathhouse. And she and the Dr. Overgaard were running this bathhouse. And she was doing this little hand reading on the side. And so my father would print her advertising in his paper, you see, and she would give him so many tickets for Brad's. And so that's how my family met her. And in the meantime, my brother had drowned, and my brother was drowned out here in Chattanooga. He worked for the Chattanooga Light Company, the light company out there in those days. And in the spring, he fell on the ice, and he was drowned. And so my sister was just a young girl, 8 years old, and my late husband, Jess, was a good-looking young fellow, and he always wanted a sister, and so in sympathizing with my sister, they were brother and sister, you see. So when I arrived on the scene, first thing, of course, I met him, and she still was his sister, and she was yet. And so that's, it was like in those days, we bought watering in cans from the water wagons, they had stoves in them, and seen pictures of those, and paid so much for our baths, and for newcomers here, that was quite a thing to go through.
You raised six children.
Yes, I have 4 girls, 2 boys.
Would you name them on the
tape? Would you like the names on them? Well, the oldest girl was born in 1912, and her name is Lila, and she's now Mrs. Fred Cox, living here in Fairbanks, up on 7th Avenue. The second girl is Carl Lorraine Rest, and she was born in 1913. She's now Mrs. Pete Smith. He was a minor out here at Esther the time she married him. And now they're living in Sacramento, California. They have 2 girls. And the next one is June. She's June West, Georgia June. She's born in 1917, and she's married now to a carpenter named Clifford Berry. They live out here on Badger, our old homestead. And then the next one was our first boy, Jesse West Jr., and he was born in 1920. And he's been working for Pan American Airways for the last 8 years, been transferred to Seattle. He's there now, itching to get back here. The next one is George Franklin West, and he was born in 1921, and now he lives in Seattle working in steel construction in the winter. Summers he come up fishing. He just left last night after a successful season of fishing down at the coast, fairly successful. And then that was George. And then the sixth one is Elizabeth Francis, and she's born in 1926, and she's now married to Carlo G. Aggie, and he's been with the Pan American for 17 years, but now he is not, and he's working in Ukiah, California, and they have their home there.
How do you spell the one?
Smet, S-N-E-T.
Mrs. Rose, I'm going to ask Chuck Kime to come up here and sit by you. He's an old newspaper man.
Well, I have talked to...
We want you to.
Yes, I have talked to Mr. Kime. In fact, I had the back of my mind that we should write a book together because I think that this story of coming up the Yukon is one that should be recorded, and we are losing so much of the old history, like in this newspaper. If we had realized what all that meant, I was just telling my family before I came down here that I wished that I had enough sense as a girl growing up to have written a diary or taken a few dates and things of when I first come, and my father started out his trip to Dawson, you know, and get more on his trip over to Chilkoot with those dogs and that terrible big press, and all the hardships those men and people went through, you know, and it's too bad we don't have more of that recorded, and I don't think as many have had that experience of, like in Seattle, getting those dogs trained for up here, and I think that a book could be written, and for instance, so many of these stories can get away from and other people take them and distort them, like so many stories are. And
well,
I would...
get in that big press.
Well, we took it in parts up over the Chilkoot. They relay it so far, leave it there, and go back and get the rest and get it all in one place. And then they relay that so far again in camp. And when they got up to Lake Bennett, they had to build the scow and had to go down through the rapids and go through all that you read so much about, you know.
How many
and, there's a book out, do you have it here at the university? It's out of print now, called The Klondike Nugget. And that tells a lot about that trip up. And my father in that book is Zach F. Hickman. Only this book, like everything else, you'll think that I've got something against everything, but this book, this Gene Allen that wrote the book, he was a ne'er-do-well. They lived next door to us all the time my father was breaking in these dogs. He had a family. His children were barefoot. He didn't take care of his family at all. His brothers helped his family along. And I don't know if he drank or what, but I know I've been over there, and there's not enough to eat in the house for the family and so forth. And so he was an ne'er-do-well. And when they were getting ready to take this Klondike Nugget up into Dawson, why, the brothers, Prim and Penny and George, they said they would send Gene up. They would make a man of him. That's where he belongs, up in the rough country like that. So they sent Gene along. And so he, with my father, brought the... Gene was sent along heading to Dawson. I think that's the way it goes. And then George and my father and a cousin of my father, the name of Brent, and he was Ed Brent. His wife is living, his widow is living down Mercer Island, Sally now. And he was a cousin of my mother's, and they brought it up. There were six men in the party that came up with the press. I don't remember the names of all of them. But Ed Brandt was one, and George Allen, and my father, and there was a man by the name of Wilkins. They had relatives around Seattle, too. I don't remember the names of all of them, but you see, those are the names that should be in history, and they brought it up.
Would you like a little rest now?
Mm-hmm. My husband, Jess West, was only 21 when he was bellhop in the old Regina Hotel in Dawson. And he tells the story of the time the famous dance hall girl had the bath in champagne, and he was one of the boys that's supposed to carry champagne up there to be bathed in. And I guess about half of the bottles had champagne in, because most of them had water. And they had transferred the bottles from water to champagne. And they sold the bottles for about $20 a bottle, and they grabbed the money on that deal. Then in 1901, he left the Regina Hotel to go to work for Captain LeBallister on Little Rock Island. And it was a thing that's blown up and down the river. And in fact, it was the Rock Island that brought this first little railroad to Fairbanks, the little engine to Fairbanks. He was on the boat when they brought this first little engine to Fairbanks. And so he worked as cabin boy for Captain LeBallister up and down the Yukon River until 1904. Then he went outside, and I guess he burned the candle both ends, because I found an old diary of his, and he sure hooped up and had a good time. And when he came back broke, he walked back. He didn't have any money, and he walked up the old white pass. He started the Skagway and walked up the valley and followed where the old stampeders had come up. In 1905, he walked up there and came in from that way. And then he... for 2 years, he hunted moose and caribou animals for the market here, and so the means spring he prospected. Then in the spring of 1908, he went up, above where the Pedro Monument is now, up in the draw up there. I think it's five above Pedro. He was mining, prospecting up there. And in doing that, he heard about there was a place that could be reworked over on Little El Dorado, five above Little El Dorado. And so in 1910, when he and I were married, our honeymoon was an old double-ender with an old blind white horse, and we went over the hill all the way from here. It took us a day and a half to get from here over to Little El Dorado, which you're traveling about an hour and a half now. And we stayed one night at the town of Gilmore, which is no more. And it was quite a little town there at Gilmore. And then we went on up to the summit there, Perry Summit, and down into Little El Dorado. And as we come down the hill with this old horse, by all up and down, if Mr. and Ms. Iverson here, they could tell you that they were on the lower creek and they were blowing whistles. And when we come down off the hill, the whole valley there was resounding with whistles blowing, because welcome the newlyweds. That night, I had a big reception, and I was the only woman there. All the miners around there and men up in our district all came for this big reception. A couple of men put on long coats and fixed themselves up to look like women so I wouldn't feel so lonesome. And so that was my reception from the week after we were married. We went out to El Dorado.
How many men were on El Dorado?
Oh, there must have been about 30 men at that time. The women were way down at the mouth, and it was too hard. They would have come up, Ms. Iris, and some of those women down there would have come up had they been able to, you know, but there's no way for transportation those days. So we had to walk down 5 miles. We were on the mail. We'd walk 5 miles down to the siding of Little El Dorado. Jess would be hoisting, and I'd be cooking, and he'd get the wooden stuff, and then in the evening after we'd get through, I'd walk the 5 miles down to the railroad and get our mail, and the little supplies we needed to replenish them back again. And we'd got a whole winter supply. And then over the after we got out there, the next day came out of supplies. There was four horses on a great big sled, bought the whole winter supplies. Under they had wolf robes and bear robes and everything covered over the supplies, and they brought them out in October. We were married on the 18th of October, and they brought the 25th of October. It was probably November the time they brought the supplies out, and we had them in the corner there. So every day I'd have to turn the crate of eggs, turn the potatoes, later on sprout the potatoes, sprout the onions, and it's just a continual work to keep your supplies from deteriorating. And then later on towards spring, well, then we had a little box for the hole in, candle the eggs, the ones that were bad, why we throw out and keep the good ones. Because by spring, most of them, I guess, were pretty thick. And that's the way we took care of, that's where everybody took care of the supplies. We weren't the only ones. All the miners, everybody took care of the supplies that way, and when we were up away from the railroad and so forth.
Mrs. Fest, do you remember anything about the Blue Parka man?
No, I've heard the stories, yes. And that, no, that was while I was here, but I didn't pay too much. I just heard that he had made a robbery, but being a young girl and all, I just didn't. I went right to work. I got here on a Saturday. I went to a funeral Saturday afternoon. That night, I went up to Eagle Hall. My mother was taking part in a play. Those days, of course, we didn't have the radios and TVs and things. We had to make our own entertainment. The Eagles were very active at that time. That's how come I'm so interested in the Eagles all the time now. And Jess was a member of the Eagles also. But even before I knew Jess, my mother was practicing, taking part in a play that the Eagles were going to put on in 1908. I think it was October the 29th or 30th. I have a picture with the date on. Could have been 1909, but I think it was 1908. That they put on this play. Little Dick Thorne, the first man that had the movies in Fairbanks, he was in the play also and coaching the actors. And Mother wanted me to walk up with her that night. I just got in that morning, 5 o'clock. I was tired and gone to a funeral afternoon in the Masonic Temple, by the way, the funeral with her. And so this evening she said, I have to go up and practice for this play. Will you come along? And I said, well, okay. And so I walked up to Eagle Hall, and they were just building up a story then. It was all full of scaffolding inside and a mess there. So we ducked around that, and seems like the girl that was take part, the maid, never showed up. And so say, here, you read this, and they shoved this paper in my hand. Right then, here I was taking part in the show. And then Monday, Sunday night, my father said, well, I got a job for you, right like that. And I said, a job? What doing? He said, we're going to be clerking the dry goods store. I said, oh, how? And he said, well, Mary Anderson up here at Fifth and Cushman needs a girl to work in the dry goods store. I know nothing about dry goods. I had dipped chocolates and been a candy worker in Seattle when I worked, and the Seattle Cracking Candy Company, and I also helped in my father's paper, so I didn't know anything about dry goods, but he said, oh, she's a good scout, she'll show you. So Monday morning, I went to work in the dry goods store. So I worked there right up until I was married, and then after I was married, between a couple of children, I went back and helped her and worked a little while, and finally she became sick and sold out. So that was up on 5th and Cushman, right where the service station is there, now the Chevrolet station there. The elite drag store in Fairbanks. I remember Frank as a boy there. He used to give me buy things for his mother, and I waited on him a few times. Frank Young, yeah. Uh-huh. They lived right over, remember, you lived right over on 6th there, back of the store there. And that time, all the sidewalks were up on stilts, 2-3 feet high. Mud in the streets and water under them, and back right across 6th Street, this great big slough. Remember, Frank, right away, a great big deep slough. And where Golden Star is, it was on stilts, up, way up off the sidewalk. You can't believe it. Now you go downhill to go into gardens, but then you went uphill to get into gardens.
Was that because of the flood?
Well, it was mud, and yes, and to keep you up out of the mud and muck and stuff.
Did they drain the land then?
No, it just dried off in the spring. It always be in the spring, when the thaw. We'd have all the snow thawing and the mud and rain down from the hills.
Still up
on the stilts? Oh, no, the walks, they fill in the streets and what they are today. That they were up on. We almost stayed home. I had 5 of my children. I am own home. We all mostly stayed at home. And those that thought they could went to the hospital. And then Mrs. Ed Herring had the large family. I believe she had all hers in the hospital, and most of them that were born here. And but the Russell family and my family and lots of families were born right in their own home. We'd have a midwife or a friend or a hired nurse, a nurse. Nurse would come in. We were lucky enough to have a friend that was a trained nurse. In fact, she nursed between times at the hospital and special cases. And she came and would help.
What hospital was it?
St. Joseph's. When I came, St. Joseph's Hospital was just that old part that's there now. The church was over across here on 2nd Avenue. It was back in about 2nd and Hall, wouldn't it be? 2nd and Hall, back in there. I watched them. We, at that time, were living over here on 1st Avenue in what is now that Italian restroom, something next to that hall. We were living there, and we watched them move the thing across the river, the church. I mean, the church across the river.
I heard one story that little cabin by the hospital where they sell gifts,
mm-hmm.
I believe, was the original hospital building. Do you know about that?
No. It never was, no. No.
No,
the hospital was built right as it is, that old part there, that wing. I have pictures of when I came in 1908 and pictures way back in 1907 or so where they were working on it, and it was always right there. And where the church is, where the church is, there was a big swimming pool in there, a great big swimming pool. It had the steam baths, very, very wonderful swimming pool. Had steam baths and locker rooms and can you remember that thing? Anyway, we used to go there and they had a slide down in and go and swim and have a wonderful time. And believe it or not, the swimming pool burnt down. And the bridge always come across from Turner Street. And you came across the bridge, and then in the spring they pulled a big span of the bridge over onto the bank. And then they'd run a little ferry and everybody would get out rowboats and charge you $2 or something, $1 or $2 way across the river. Because that'd be in the spring, you know, when it break up. Because they wanted to save that span, but the ice would come and shut out the pilings, and people would bet on which would be the last piling to go and things like that. A lot of excitement when the ice went out then, because there's a lot of water in the river. The channel came down through. Always had floods. Always had floods too. Like now, the lower, the upper part of here on Wendell would always be underwater, and the lower end here would be underwater. And then, of course, they'd have to drive the pilings and then put a big span back on. Big sign across there, walk your horses. And
they'd pull the span off each
pole. Yes, they'd pull it off. And then they had a ferry. Then they'd run a ferry across, you see, to take people back and forth. And before they probably were getting the ferry in, they couldn't just now put the ferry in, but they'd have rowboats and row passengers back and forth. People make a little money running back and forth on the river in rowboats until they got either the ferry going or the bridge going.
Was that ferry near where the Steese Highway Bridge is now?
The Steese Highway Bridge. There was a ferry there, too. We had two ferries in the early days. Yes, in the early days, there was a ferry down there off of Wendell Avenue, went across there, about where the bridge is now. Yes, there's a ferry there. I think I have pictures, or there's pictures around of that ferry. But this ferry would come off of Turner Street here. There's a great big pole. As we look across, from this side, look up Cushman Street, I meant to say up Cushman, to the left of that, there was a big warehouse, a big building in there on pilings, right on the river. In fact, it was a dock, we called it. Well, just at the end of that dock was this huge big poles anchored and had the cable across, and that would take the ferry across there. They had a slip going down, and that's where the ferry was. And then as you come across, you're talking about the Alaska Citizen, right at the end of Turner Street, as you come across, to the right was this large building, and there was a frame fair, and we had sort of a dance hall upstairs, and the Alaska Citizen was underneath. And at the end of that was this Mr. Miller, Frank Miller's saloon. I forgot what the car was, big log building, and it was his saloon. And Miner's Home, that's right, Miner's Home Saloon. That was here, so Frank Miller. And then upstairs, we used to have dances up there with the Citizen, and we used to call it the Thespian Club. We had all of us that took part in these amateur shows, why we call this the Thespian Club. And Mrs. Caskey, Ms. J. Harmon Caskey, she and her husband had the Alaska Citizen. And she was the president of this Thespian Club. She used to put on a lot of plays. She had a wonderful voice. And she and her sister, Ms. Jack Robarts, and her cousin, Ms. Bench, and Olava, she used to take part in these shows. And they were just a lot of fun. We had more fun getting ready for them, I guess, than actually putting on. And this old auditorium, Mr. Wickersham Apartments now, that was where we put the shows on. It was a beautiful stage and lovely scenery. And they had balconies and boxes, and it was a wonderful big building. Why they couldn't have kept it up, because we certainly needed it through the years, but no one seemed to be ever able to keep that building up, because we needed it, you know, for things, but no one seemed to make any money on it. And so it just gradually became what it is now. but it had some wonderful shows there and dances and great times.
A little while ago, you mentioned Gordon's story. Mm-hmm. Mike Griffey told me some time ago that that used to be the fanciest gambling joint in Fairbanks.
Well, not since my time. I never knew of it. When I came to Fairbanks, it was called the Glass Block, Cribb's Glass Block. And the whole front, for all those windows that boarded up, was all glass. And this man, Cribb, rather than Harry Cribb, his name was, he owned the, he, in fact, he built the house that Harry Abercoff lives in now, there at Six and Cushman. It was a very beautiful home at the time, beautiful lawn, and he kept it up wonderfully. I remember his wife used to be out there watering the lawn in a long lace dress and a silk parasol over her head watering the lawn. You'd go by, and because we sure dressed in those days. But anyway, this Cribb block, the glass block, as they called it, it was divided up in several divisions. And on the corner of Fifth and Cushman was a saloon, a liquor store, and Harry Atwood ran that, one of our old pioneer men. Harry Atwood had the liquor store there. Then next to him was Mr. Cribb's place. He had sort of a fashion door sales. He sold windows, fancy windows and glass and hardware, for mostly for doors and windows. And then next to him was a very elite dress shop for women, hats and things. Captain Mills dress shop was on the corner down of 4th there. And it's never been known as that to me. Did you, as a gambling? I never heard of it being a gambling place.
You mean the Gordon Block?
That's what Mike told me.
Oh, no.
Mike's mistaken.
And then when Gordon burned out, Gordon used to have a store, his original store, because at one time I was going to quit my job and go work for him. I'm losing my shoe. Anyway, Gordon's store was on 3rd there, where the Golden Dock Jewelry Store is now. Gordon had a very lovely store there, and it was a hotel up above that called the 3rd Avenue Hotel, wasn't it? And there was a restaurant in there, and Gordon's store took over almost half of the building. Then there was a little restaurant, and then up on the corner was where the, on the 4th, was where the old Florida was, up on the corner of 4th and Cushman. And that's where the big red fence and the gates were across.
Yes. Mrs. Rust, could you tell us something of the social life in Fairbanks, the way they dressed for their dances and the men's race?
Well, I think in the early days, the dances were more graceful and beautiful than they are now, because we never went to a dance without a long dress on. And if it's one of the better class dances, like it would be the Eagles Grand Ball or the Masons, the two that gave the big dance was usually the Eagles and the Masonic, and sometimes the churches would wind up with a ball after the big bazaar. They'd run the bazaar about 3 days, and they'd wind up with a grand ball. And when you go to any of these dances, well, you always wear a long dress, and usually those days, cleaning was a hard job. You know, when you paid quite a bit of money for a beautiful dress, you couldn't have it cleaned every time you wore it. And so the men always carried a handkerchief. They didn't wear gloves. Quite a few of the men would wear gloves. But if you didn't have gloves, you carried a handkerchief and would hold it at the lady's back. And if any girl got her dress soiled from any man's hands, well, she wouldn't dance with that man anymore. Because there were lots of men and not too many girls, and we could be very independent. And if a girl went to a dance and didn't dance every dance, if we had to sit out a dance by her evening spread, we were a wallflower. We weren't popular. That's all there was to it. And we'd go up here to Eagle Hall, and at that time there's a great big stove, a big old wood stove, and they didn't have coal those days, had wood. There'd be a big old stove in each diagonal corner of Eagle Hall. And picture if you can, this old wooden stove, but the hall would be decorated beautiful. And then here's the women in their long dresses. I know one lady here, Mrs. Taxton, when I was working at Mary Anderson Douglas' store, I sold her a dress for $150, all going up and beautiful. Going into that hall, if you can picture Eagle Hall now, going to that hall, a stove in each corner, this girl with her beautiful gold dress on, white, we all had white kid gloves, they weren't silk and things, now they were kid, and big white gloves up to here, and her husband in his swallowtail suit and dancing in Eagle Hall. And they were beautiful, graceful dances. I like to remember that most of the men would wear either tuxedos or swallowtail. They never allowed in dance hall in shirt sleeves, and they were very snooty at their dances. If anybody had a little savory, unsavory name, or done some little thing that wasn't just right, you couldn't, like now, go in and have just anybody in the hall with you. There'd be whispers around first thing you know why you wouldn't see that lady. She'd be asked to go. And they were very, very fussy about the dances and who went there in the early days.
1 minute. You have 1 minute.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What was the toughest thing for women to endure in those early days?
Well, I just don't know that would be the toughest. I never found anything I considered really tough. We just used to taking things, you know, and I imagine one thing would be the transportation, the walking with those long skirts trying to hold them up in the spring out of the mud, and in the winter time in the snow, and we used to carry our dancing shoes in our pockets or a bag, and our escort would put our shoes in their pocket. When we get to the hall, I would change our winter shoes into the dancing shoes, and I don't know. And of course, raising a family, the hardest part was not having any washing machines, dryers. Your house was always full of diapers and wet clothes, and in the kitchen you kind of cook back and under things. And I'd say that was the hardest part, is the lack of water in the early days. In keeping a family anyway, I'd say it was the lack of water and modern facilities. Because it wasn't. The water was hard. We used to have a great big five of them, big 50-gallon drums, and we would fill that. When we finally got our own pump, we'd fill that. And then the night before, I'd wash them, I would dump the whole can of rye in there and stir it around and settle. And you'd be surprised at the stuff in the bottom of that can, a couple of inches of certain stuff in the bottom of that can from our well. But we learned later that we could drive the wells deeper, you know, and we got automatic pumps by putting in filters and such. But when we got water to the can, this well this man had, he was very deep, and he sold good clear water. The water he sold was clear and had no trouble then, but just anyone else. Mm-hmm.
End of second part.
I guess this is the end of the second part, and I've enjoyed talking to you all.
Mm-hmm.